Moncrief on News Talk.
For just how long have people in Ireland been playing stick and ball games? In today's Irish Examiner, Dr. Paul Rouse from UCD has been outlining the history. Afternoon, Paul.
How are you, Sean?
Originally, was it called hurling or was it called something else?
It depends on what you mean by originally, which sounds like a terrible academic's answer. But the short version of a long story is that stick and ball games have been played back in Ireland for as long as we've got a historical record. We know that from, say, the Brehon Laws, the early Irish period. We know it from medieval poetry. We know it from newspaper reports then in the early modern period. So that's the 1600s onwards. So it was called by different names. Obviously, the language was different. It was Imán or Barda, sometimes in Irish, or it was called Cumán after the stick itself being a hurl, so which was again changed in English into Commons. So, and then there was another game which emerged in the 19th century called Hurley. And you know that in certain parts of Dublin, there are still people who call hurling Hurley. Mm. So the game, as organised by the Gaelic Athletic Association from 1884, when they reached back into history, looked at the stories of Cú Chulainn and of Satanta and everything to do with that, the game that they took out of history and remade in the modern way with clubs and organisations and set rules and championships was called hurling from the very beginning of 1884.
Okay. And the Cumán itself, did it always have more or less the same shape?
No. So if you look at the hurls that lads use now on the field, they're actually getting shorter. And what's there for those of your listeners who don't know hurling, the bottom of the hurl, the broader bit, is called the boss. That boss has got broader and heavier as the hurl has got shorter over recent years. Previous to this, the hurl was much longer and much narrower in the way, we'll say, if anyone is familiar with shinty, was very similar to a shinty stick.
Right, okay. But say 100 years ago, or more than 100 years, 1,000 years ago, would it have been then a much longer and not so broad?
Yeah, well, and not made in the modern way, so much longer and not so broad, and often cut from ditches, sticks cut from ditches and kind of shaved and carved into ways that made them used to play a stick and ball game. On roads and on fields and on beaches, on anywhere, on commons, anywhere there was space available.
Yeah, and but the sort of wood, because as we all know, there's certain sorts of woods that don't lend themselves very well to be to have hurleys made from them. So back then, would they have been choosy about that?
I suppose if you look at, there is no hurler now who doesn't want to play with an ash hurley. Everybody plays with ash hurleys, more or less. And I know there are some synthetic hurls that come and go and they tried for a while, but no one has really cracked that market properly, if truth be told. It is the ash hurl that is used and predominates. But if you go back, there was a tour by Irish hurlers of America in 1888 and they ran out of ash hurls. So they made them out of hickory, and the hickory went into pieces when they started to play matches with them. So the desire, and that kind of tells you of how competitive these supposed exhibition matches that they were putting on for Americans were. They were anything but exhibitions. They were exceptionally physical and competitive. But if you look at, say, when hurling was being played in Argentina by Irish emigrants, it thrived from the 1890s. Until 1914, but then they couldn't bring hurleys out on ships because they didn't have ash to make it. The game kind of died away after that, and as the community aged as well, that also had an impact in it. But all across the world where Irish people have played the stick and ball game of hurling, they've tried to make hurleys out of ash.
Yeah. So the ball 1,000 years ago, what did that consist of?
Okay, so if anyone's in Mayo at any point, they should go into the National Museum in Castlebar. It's a brilliant place anyway, the folk life, country life, or folk and country life museum. It's that rural section of it. Mm. And there's an exhibition that was put on there by Clodagh Doyle, which was the oldest hurl in the country, which is the found in the bog in Derrys in County Offaly. And it's dated about 400 to 500 years ago. But the oldest hurling ball is 1,000 years old. And more or less 1,000 years old. And they've all been carbon dated. And what they were made of is they were made of horse hair or cow's hair, where they combed out the hair at a particular time. They made them in the ball. They soaked them. They wrapped them, used twine. Sometimes they used leather as well to make them up. And these, the only ones that have survived were ones that got immersed in bogs. And as peat was harvested over the last 120, 30 years, these hair hurling balls, just the bog gave them back to people. And these people, like really brilliant collectors, gave them to the National Museum, where people can go in and see them. And they're extraordinary artifacts to see that this is, it's a kind of an enduring test, a legacy of 1,000 years of play.
Yeah, God, that's extraordinary. Now, camogie, how did camogie originate, or are there various forms of that?
Oh, okay. So, so when Michael Cusick and Maurice Davin founded the Gaelic Athletic Association in 1884, they made a huge thing about opening it up to all classes and all creeds. But they were talking about men. Mm. They were not talking about women. And the Victorian sports revolution that constructed soccer and rugby and cricket, every all those games that we know that were taken from the past and modernized in those years, all of them, it was about men. The place of women in the sporting world was extremely limited. It was confined to maybe mixed doubles or certain slow games of tennis, or there would be golf played off shorter tees, but certainly women were not expected to play games that were dynamic and things, because it was perceived to inhibit a woman's capacity to give birth at the time. This was not just social convention, it was also scientific, repeated in scientific medical textbooks. So those women who wished to play, and as somebody who has trained a Gaelic football team, a ladies' Gaelic football team, for 12 years, a girls' team that brought them through to minor and has helped with a camogie team across that exactly that same span. The notion that girls or women should be less competitive or less interested in sport than men is, of course, absolute silage. Mm. It just doesn't hold water. So inevitably, women who saw the men playing began to organise themselves to play games. So, and it was absolutely connected with the Gaelic League in Dublin. And the Gaelic League in Dublin was filled with young, independent women who were often up in the city working as teachers or working and joining the civil service, beginning to explore that life of the single woman in the city. And one of the things that they did was join the Gaelic League. And in the Gaelic League in Dublin, hurling was very strong and women resolved to play the game themselves. So they began to go to the Phoenix Clonturk Park, which is on the north side of Dublin, first of all, and then out to the Phoenix Park on trams, hiding the hurls that they had under their coat to protect from ridicule. And they go up and they go into play. So that begins in the end of 1903 through 1904. The Camogie Association is 120 years old. This year's big gala banquet tomorrow night and their finals in a week's time is a massive moment for Camogie, and it's testimony to those pioneers. But of course, and this is where the social convention comes in, it could not be perceived that women played the same game as men, because men were fearless and brave and heroic in the hurling field, and that would be somehow tarnished by the very fact that women would play the same game. And of course, I'm being facetious when I say that. But in that, so they named it a different game. They made the pitch shorter. They had fewer players involved. So it was 12 players. But it was essentially the same game.
Yeah. Wasn't there a game that they played on Inishmore, which is kind of a variant on hurling, but it sounds, they called it something that sounded like camogie or camoga.
Come on, yeah. So basically, the mistake we make always when we talk about sport is we look from the present backwards. Mm. And it's an understandable mistake, because we perceive, for example, that rugby was a game where people always ran with the ball under their arms and tried to score tries in the corner, or that soccer was a game where you couldn't hand the ball ever. And of course, in the first rules for soccer, you could actually catch the ball if it came to you on the full. And in the first rules of Gaelic football, there were throw-ins from the sideline. So these are borrowings that go all over the place. So what emerged as different games over time was a process that took years and years and years. But in all of this, games kind of shed a skin as they go along. And one of the great social conventions in Ireland was to play with a stick and ball game dependent on the geography of where you played. So it's fine to play big broad-based hurl, strike the ball in the air, drive it 100 yards. If you're playing out in a 200-yard long field or 180-yard long field with loads of width on it, but what if you don't have that space? Well, then you design a game that's suitable to the environment in which you play. And of course, Inishmore, like, incredibly beautiful, but not a place, I don't know, 100 years ago, where there was freedom to set up a huge, big playing field on it. So they played where they could, and that involved, and they played with the materials that they had at their disposal. So that involved that. So a game that evolved there was kind of like a, it's kind of like hockey, really, playing the ball on the ground.
Yeah. Paul, is it a hurl or a hurley?
Oh, the culture wars. for me, so I'm from Offaly, and it will only ever be a hurl. And I've only ever called it a hurl. But if you go south into Munster, it's a hurley. Mm-hmm. And that's it. It's like people who get upset over whether you call soccer or whether you call it football. It's one of those things, you call it what you will. So the article that I wrote that you rang me about, that published today, is published in this amazing 28-page supplement in the Irish Examiner, Sean. And I hope you don't mind me mentioning it, because it's a window not just into hurling, what's being produced here, but it's a window also into newspapers and the way newspapers used to be. And it's an artifact that's incredible, beautifully laid out by the people there. It's kind of a collector's item, and there's only a few left in the shops. Like, it's done exceptionally well. But if you read that piece, if you read my piece in it, I call it a hurl. But I put EY in brackets afterwards. But if you read absolutely every other piece in it, and I will only ever write about it as a hurl, but if you read every other piece in it, they, like by Liam Sheedy, for example, or Anthony Daly, they all talk about hurley. They call it a hurley.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but they're all Munster men.
Yeah, well, there's room for us all.
What do you call it, Sean?
I intend to call it a hurley, actually. Yeah.
And, okay. Yeah. Because it is really interesting. If you go to Kilkenny, it's a hurl.
Yeah.
As well. So there's kind of that South Leinster. I don't talk to people from Leash, so I don't really know what they call it. So, that's the great culture war.
That's the wound that will never heal. You can direct your complaints to Dr. Paul Rouse, the professor in the School of History in UCD, and you can, of course, read all about that in today's Irish Examiner. Paul, thanks a million.
Thank you, Sean.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 p.m. on News Talk.